Okay, then. Hello, everyone. This is Volts for March 13th, 2024. How is Ira doing? I'm your host, David Roberts. During the previous U.S. brush with climate policy, back around 2010, when the Waxman-Markey bill was being discussed, energy system modeling tools were too slow and too crude to contribute much. Without the ability to do rapid, on-the-fly modeling of various policy options, it was difficult to say with any confidence what effects those policies would have. Consequently, the public debate was based almost entirely on vibes. It did not go well. It is different these days. Energy sector modeling has progressed in leaps and bounds and is now capable of almost real-time analysis of policy proposals. That meant that the dialogue among policymakers and the public in the run-up to the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act was uncharacteristically informed. We knew, to a decent approximation, what effect different options would have on greenhouse gas emissions. We also have, here on the backside of IRA, an unusual profusion of information about what has happened in the economy in its wake, thanks in part to the creation of the Clean Investment Monitor, a collaboration between analysts at the Rhodium Group and MIT. It closely tracks public and private investment in every sector of the clean energy economy. So, we had models beforehand to predict what would happen. We now have almost 2 years of data about what did happen. Do they match? Were the modeling predictions correct? Is IRA doing what its backers said it would? To find out, I contacted Trevor Hauser, a partner and lead analyst at the Rhodium Group. We talked about which sectors have seen the predicted successes and which haven't, what kinds of trends emerge from the investment data, and how IRA's performance to date is informing Rhodium's subsequent projections. All right, then, with no further ado, Trevor Hauser of the Rhodium Group, it is so great to finally get you on the podcast, man.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to be here.
It's been a long time coming. I'm excited for this. Got a lot to talk about today, but I just will say I've been following your work since you were just a little baby analyst, and I was just a little baby journalist, and it's...
I still remember the day I was doing my very first congressional testimony, terrified, to the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, on the Recovery Act.
Oh, funny.
And some, you know, very early energy system modeling, trying to analyze the effect of different provisions of ARRA, and this wild-haired, bearded reporter came running up to me after the session, and a friendship was born.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful story. And now here we are, things, something passed. Wacky.
Wacky.
Okay. So let's start by just talking a little bit about the Clean Investment Monitor. Like, what is that? How did it come about? And what is it for? Why did it get set up?
Yeah, so the goal with the Clean Investment Monitor is, over the past few years, there's been, as your listeners know well, some of the most consequential energy and climate legislation passed in U.S. history, the combination of the Inflation Reduction Act and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or otherwise known as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, that include long-term incentives and grants for clean energy technology, clean transportation, and other emission-reducing investments. And there were modeled projections in the run-up to the passage of the IIJA and the IRA by Rhodium and other groups, and then analysis right after the passage about what the potential impact of that legislation would be. And the Clean Investment Monitor, the goal is to provide as close to real time as possible data on how that investment is going, what sectors, what technologies are attracting the most investment, which federal funding programs are moving quickly, which are not, what parts of the country that investment is occurring in, whether it's having its intended effects in terms of community economic development. to provide that type of information to stakeholders and policymakers so that they can identify where things are going well, where it's not, where more work is needed.
Right. And this is, I mean, it's a little weird to me that something like this didn't already exist. I mean, this is, was this all just public information that you're just kind of gathering and putting in a clear format?
Yeah, so it's collecting a lot of different existing data sources and harmonizing them and putting them into one place. But then there's also this very labor-intensive process of it's a team of analysts that are combing through company filings, news reports to capture announcements on investments in new manufacturing facilities, let's say. But then also to track, like, have they broken ground on that facility? How much are they investing this year versus last year in that facility? How quickly is it ramping up production? So we benefit from some existing data sets that just need to be pulled together and transformed and harmonized. But then there's a lot of extremely hardworking research analysts that are combing through Google News alerts and reading mind-numbing 10K filings from publicly traded companies.
Oh, no. I just have a couple of general questions about modeling before we get into the specifics. I'm just a little bit curious. I mean, like I said in the intro, it was a little bit of a new thing in the world to have policy being discussed and crafted in the presence of what is basically real-time modeling. I mean, so just a sort of abundance of information about what would happen. I wonder if you had any sort of impressions of like how that changed the policymaking process or how it differed from other policymaking processes you've seen. Like, I want to say sort of in retrospect that the whole thing like worked out pretty well. Like that's kind of how you want things to go. I mean, obviously we'd like the politics to be better, but in terms of like informed debate, it seemed like weirdly informed.
Yeah, it's a great question. Maybe let me answer it just from a Rhodium lens and what our journey has been on yeah. this, because as we talked about a minute ago, you know, we did our first energy system modeling to try to inform a live fire policy exercise with Waxman Markey, and then later with the Recovery Act. And over time have been refining and evolving both our modeling tools and the way that we engage policymakers and stakeholders to figure out how to make it more useful and to learn from past mistakes. And in other modeling groups I've been on the same journey. And a couple of the things that we have learned is that, so one, there's things you need to do to the tools just to be able to run them more quickly, to be responsive on time scales.
Is that something about the tools themselves, or is it just more computing power that allows this new speed?
So there's a portion of it that's about the tools. It's building the models and building computational platforms that let you run them quickly.
Mm.
But it's also just about prep. It is, so if you think about with the IRA, about 2 years before the passage of the IRA, our team at Rhodium started thinking through possible electoral outcomes in the 2020 election and gaming out in those electoral outcomes what types of policy proposals might be put forward and began speculatively modeling them, right, to work through some of the places where the models weren't working well, where we would need to make improvements to them. And you have to do a lot of that work in advance if you want to be able to respond quickly to policy developments as they emerge. You kind of need to have a library of potential policies,
right,
that you've worked through the kinks of modeling so that when you get the specifics about, okay, this tax credit's going to be extended for this period of time, at this level, you can do that analysis much quicker than if the very first time you're trying to figure out how to model a tax credit in your model is when it's being proposed in Congress, you're going to be a year too late.
And you found lawmakers sort of eager for this, like eager for the new information. You didn't have to fight to push this into the process, in other words.
No, I think both legislative staff and administration officials and key stakeholders, environmental groups, unions, industry associations, others, were pretty desperate for objective, independent analysis. And, you know, and in part because climate's a fundamentally quantitative exercise, it comes down to this unit of measure of a ton and against a backdrop of a very specific U.S. target under the Paris Agreement.
Yeah.
Of a 50 to 52% reduction, a top of mind question for all of those stakeholders was, okay, how far does it get us? How do we design a policy that is designed in a way that it can pass, but also does as much as possible to move us towards that target? And yeah, I think particularly with the Inflation Reduction Act, the incredible congressional staff that were working nights and weekends for years to put together that legislation also were looking for independent analysis to just anchor their own thinking relative to what they hear from stakeholder groups around any particular piece, right? Because everybody has a particular component that they care about a lot.
Yeah.
And if you're drafting that kind of legislation, you want to know, what does it all add up to? What matters more or doesn't from an emissions standpoint?
It's just worth noting, I think, like everybody going through this process of policy formation, working from the same information about what it would do is just like, it's a little bit crazy. It's a little bit of a new thing in the world. And just a final modeling question, and this is a very basic question, but like, I think just like if you're kind of a normie out in the world and someone brings this model to you and says, hey, we have a model and here's what it shows, you're sort of like, just have to accept it. But there's no real magic here. So just say a little bit about, you know, so you're like modeling what these tax credits will do to EV sales, for instance. Like, just sort of like, what are the types of information that go into making that calculation?
Yeah, like what's the mechanics in the model for it?
Yeah, what are the mechanics of doing that?
Yeah, so you need to have a bunch of information about what vehicles cost and what they'll cost in the future. Now, in areas where there's a lot of uncertainty about what vehicles will cost in the future, like what will the price of lithium-ion batteries be? A kind of prudent approach to modeling, one that we take, is you use a range of potential future changes so that you are reasonably confident that your projections are capturing the full range of likely real-world outcomes. Then you need to assess consumer behavior. How responsive will customers be to a tax credit? What range of EVs are available? Are there going to be enough models available that they'll satisfy the full range of consumer preferences, right? What's the price of gasoline going to be? Right. So when someone is deciding between an EV or an internal combustion engine, they're comparing the price of electricity to the price of gasoline. So you need to know what both of those things will be. And again, it's impossible to predict specifically what any one of those inputs will look like 5-10 years from now.
Yeah.
So you try to develop reasonable ranges using research from other groups, as well as your own team's judgment. And then you build a model or operate a model that can capture the interaction of those factors. So in the total cost of ownership of an electric vehicle, how much of it is the battery price? How much of it is the cost of electricity compared to an internal combustion engine vehicle? How much is the cost of gasoline versus the cost of repairs versus the upfront cost of the car?
And so there are some judgment calls and some predictions made. Because I just want to frame this. So like, if the actual results are off from the models, it's not that the policy was bad or wrong or that the model was bad or wrong. It's just like you're predicting a lot of future developments and prediction is hard.
And it's important as a modeler to regularly go back and look and do so bravely at what did we get right? What did we get wrong? Right. And that's one thing that we're trying to do with the Clean Investment Monitors as we get real-time information of what's actually happening. Compare that to the model projections and ask ourselves, like, is that close to what was modeled? If not, why? Was it a wrong assumption in the modeling or has the world changed in a way that we couldn't predict?
Right. I want to get into some of that later. But like one example that I kind of wanted to ask about specifically here is interest rates, you know, because every discussion I have practically these days, one way or the other, comes back to interest rates and their, you know, unwelcome effects on investment. Did you predict the course of interest rates and how big of an effect does that have on the results?
I mean, if you go back to like 2020 or early 2021, our projections did not have a large increase in interest rates, right? Now, we update our core modeling every year through our taking stock report for the US, which is the baseline that we then use for policy analysis. As we got into 2021, 2022, 2023, and interest rates were rising, then that starts showing up in your projections as well. But yeah, that type of macro shock is exactly the type of thing that's pretty challenging to capture in a model. One important thing to flag when modeling a policy is usually what you're trying to focus policymakers on in your modeling is not so much the absolute outcome, like this thing will be at this point in this year, as much as what is the delta relative to a baseline of from the policy.
Yeah.
And you're including the same assumptions both in your baseline and in the delta, right? So for example, in assessing the impact of the IRA, which by 2030 was, you know, between a 700 million metric ton and a 1 gigaton a year intervention, that delta, the interest rate assumptions are both in the baseline and in the policy scenario,
right?
And so if there's a shock, an unforeseen shock that makes the point prediction in the future wrong, it's less likely to change the delta between the baseline and the policy future. Does that make sense?
Like they both shift in the same direction.
They both shift in the same direction. So a high interest rate future means that the non-IRA baseline would have been much different than the baseline against which we and other modeling groups were analyzing the impact of the IRA.
Yeah. That's if you can get policymakers to interpret models the right way, which
Correct.
Is a no small thing.
No small fee.
So let's talk then about, so we have, what, a year and a half of data, post-IRA data. That's what we're working with here. So let's start first with kind of the big overall numbers, sort of like how much private investment in clean energy broadly did IRA pull forward? And how do we know how much of that IRA is responsible for?
Okay, so if you look at 2023, there was $239 billion in investment in clean energy and transportation. So in the Clean Investment Monitor, we define that as investment in manufacturing clean energy technologies and clean vehicles, investment in the deployment of those clean energy technologies and vehicles, both in the wholesale energy market and in the retail sector, right? So $239 billion. That was up 38% year on year. And if you compare it to 2021, there was $139 billion in clean energy investment in the US. And in 2023, it was $239 billion. So 80% plus increase over that 2 year period in clean energy investment in the US. And that's adjusted for inflation.
Now, presumably the arc, the line was going up and to the right already.
Yep. So how much was IRA responsible?
Yeah, and is there a hard and fast answer to that question?
Yeah, so we don't know for sure. It's very difficult to do that type of attribution analysis. I mean, we can tell you what the models predicted the delta would be, but it's hard to say in reality. Qualitatively, what we see when you look under the hood at the data, I would break it into three categories. So there's a category of technologies for which I think it's pretty safe to say that IRA and the bipartisan infrastructure bill are really responsible for the majority of the investment, that those incentives fundamentally change the economics, right? So I would put in that category most of the clean energy manufacturing, the EV supply chain, battery supply chain, solar. That's really been, I think, to date, the most successful part of the Inflation Reduction Act is just how much it's catalyzing clean energy manufacturing investment and in lots of different technology segments. And then the other would be in emerging climate technology, so hydrogen and carbon management.
Yeah, we'll touch on those later too.
Yeah, so those are the ones that are really growing exponentially. And if you look at the incentives provided in the IRA, they really are transformative in terms of the overall economics. Okay, so that's been one. Category two are technologies that were already had achieved escape velocity, right? They're already on that upswing. And the incentives in the IRA are accelerating that, but it's hard to know exactly how much, right? So I would put in that bin utility scale solar and storage that account for the majority of the utility scale clean energy investment that we're seeing. And then there's a third category, which are technologies that were investments declining despite the IRA, right? Now, it's entirely possible that without the IRA, they would be declining faster, but they're really struggling. The incentives in the IRA have not been able to overcome the other headwinds, and that's primarily wind and heat pumps, and we can talk about those in more detail, too.
So we can say, I mean, intuitively, you want to say they'd probably be doing even worse without the incentives, but...
Yeah, it's directionally that has to be true. The question is just the magnitude.
Right. And then also what your recent report did, which was interesting, is tease out how much government money is being spent, how much public money is being spent. Because the whole sort of the whole policy premise of IRA is that government investment catalyzes private investment, right? It pulls in private investment. So there's $239 billion private investment relative to how much public spending?
$239 billion is the total investment. And then the federal spending would be a portion of that. So unfortunately, to do this comparison, we only have the federal investment for fiscal year 2023. So that runs through September 30th. So we've got to look at a slightly different time horizon, but it'll give you a sense of the ratio. So in fiscal year, government fiscal year 2023, so that would have been October 1st, 2022 through September 30th, 2023, right? Mm-hmm. In that period, there was $220 billion in total investment. Of that, $34 billion is federal investment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's a 5-to-6 ratio between the public and the private.
What do we make of that? What do you learn from that? What conclusions can you draw from that ratio?
Yeah, so first, it is clear that the vast majority of the investment required to decarbonize the U.S. is going to be private, right? It's not going to come from the federal government.
Right.
And the federal government has a very powerful role to play in providing incentives that shape the direction of that investment in a low carbon way. And so far, those investments, the majority of which are tax credits. So one really unique thing that we're doing at the Clean Investment Monitor is project by project estimating what the tax credit uptake is likely to be and then rolling that up. Because while we get government reporting on grants and loans, we don't have data on tax credit uptake. So we need to estimate it.
So presumably that's private information to the company, so that's not made public anywhere.
Exactly. It's in their IRS filings, but because of confidentiality, the government can't, you know, they, in a couple of years, they will probably release aggregate estimates, but you don't get the kind of timely and detailed information that you need from government sources. And so we have to estimate it from the bottom up.
Right. And so, I mean, it seems like on its face that if private spending is, what did you say, six times public spending, that is working, right? Seems like good news. Seems like public capital is, in fact, catalyzing large amounts of private capital.
We think it's a pretty good ratio. I think it's a pretty good ratio. It's a pretty good deal for taxpayers.
Was the ratio in question? Like, did you, you know what I mean? Like, did you have questions in your mind about, like, what is that ratio going to be?
Yeah, and I think in particular, I mean, in some ways with tax credits, some of the ratio you kind of know because it's a tax credit that's covering 30% of investment, right? Or 10% of the cost of production. So that ratio should be relatively constant. A question is just the magnitude, like how much investment actually happens once those incentives are in play. But I think for those of us who are wading through the details of the tax code provisions. I think for the general public, there is a perception or can be a perception that this type of investment activity is solely being paid for by the taxpayer, right?
Yes. And that's certainly how Republicans talk about it, right? Like, what is the cost of the bill, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And so you can look at what is the fiscal cost of the bill, and you need to balance against that. What are the benefits of the bill, both in terms of the emissions that it's reducing, but also the private sector investment that it's catalyzing and associated job creation and local economic development activity.
Right. And IRA was a lot of things, a lot of different things, only some of which have started to actually spend money, right? So Do you have a good global sense of sort of the money spending provisions in IRA? How much are actually spending money? Like, presumably we're going to see that public amount go up as all the spending programs come online. Is that fair?
Yeah, though less than you would think, because the majority of the federal investment under the IRA is tax credits.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about tax credits is that they are effective pretty much immediately. You don't have to have a team at an agency that is taking proposals and allocating grants. You change the law, and literally the next day, companies can start claiming the credits on their tax returns. Now, for some of the new tax credits that were created, so the IRA, for some tax credits, they existed before and the IRA extended them.
Yeah.
Right? And for those, companies know how to take advantage of those credits. The rules weren't really changing. That was pretty straightforward. The effect of those was pretty immediate. For other credits that were new in the IRA, the Treasury Department and the IRS had to develop guidance on how to interpret the legislative language in the IRA. And so for hydrogen, for example, for green hydrogen, the 45V tax credit, that guidance didn't come until late in the year. And so as a result, there hasn't been much tax credit adoption under 45V because industry was waiting on the guidance to be issued by the Treasury Department. Whereas the EV purchase credit and the clean electricity tax credits, those were increases and extensions of credits that already existed. And so they moved much quicker into the economy. Now, going forward, we'll see of that $34 billion in federal investment, only about $400 million of that was grants and loans. Now, important caveat, loans here, we're looking at the fiscal cost of the loan, which is not the total amount of the loan. It's how much that loan costs taxpayers in terms of the subsidy provided. So of the $34 billion, only a small fraction to date has been grants and loans. That loan and grant number will grow going forward because those programs take a little bit longer to stand up.
So let's get to the meat of the thing. Let's talk about some sectors and what we found out. So let's start with EVs. Rhodium did a report basically honing in on two sectors, EVs and electricity. How did they perform relative to what the models said? And the story for EVs is positive. Basically, they're on track to what you expected. Is that more or less right?
Yeah, despite what you would have read in the news for the past 3 months.
Yeah, I know, despite the cavalcade of of negative stories and doomsaying, they're on track, doing as expected, doing what policymakers thought they would do, doing what you projected, more or less.
Yep, and so this is both Rhodium, and then collaborating with us on this was the REPEAT project at Princeton and in Energy Innovation. So those were two of the other groups that provided a lot of the modeling before and after the IRA. So we all got together to do the brave thing of let's compare the real world to what we said was going to happen and how does it look.
And held hands and jumped
exactly,
in together.
And jumped in together. And for EVs, in 2023, EVs accounted, well, ZEV, so it includes plug-in hybrids, battery electric vehicles, and then a tiny number of fuel cell vehicles. It's like 13 Toyota Mirais sold in California. So the zero-emission vehicles accounted for 9.2% of all passenger vehicle sales. And that is at the top of the range of the modeling groups had projected.
I had thought that the strict domestic content requirements, et cetera, that Manchin insisted on these, which restricted the pool of EVs that they applied to at the beginning, would slow things down. And then you got interest rates. I mean, it seems like, like all these negative stories were, inspired by true events, as they say. So what explains EVs' good performance here?
So I think it's a couple things. One is that this is a place where the delay in issuing guidance for the tax credits actually benefited sales because the guidance, the implementation of those domestic requirements, it took a little while for the Treasury Department to finalize those regulations.
Oh, and were the old rules in place while they were working out the new rules?
It was like a hybrid. So it was an extension at the new level, but there was a transition period where there was a greater number of models that qualified. So that's one. Second is that a lot of those requirements only apply to purchased vehicles, not to fleet vehicles, right? So they apply to personal purchased vehicles, but not fleet vehicles. And so if you lease an electric vehicle, often the credit is available independent of some of those restrictions. And there's a much larger share of leased vehicles over the past couple of years than there had been previously in the EV segment.
And PHEVs, plug-ins, kind of came on stronger than expected. Are they a bigger part of the ZEV portion than you expected?
So they grew a little bit quicker than expected. Their total numbers are fairly small. The market for traditional hybrids is much larger. The plug-in hybrids, they are growing faster than expected, but the total numbers are pretty small. So it's still the battery electric vehicle sales that drive the headline numbers.
And is there a tidy story to tell about how the results in the EV space so far are informing your subsequent projections? I mean, I guess this just says, yeah, your modeling is right on. So you're just going to keep the modeling in place. Are you tweaking anything? Is there anything you've learned that's tweaking your expectations about subsequent EV sales?
Yeah, I mean, as part of the model updates we do each year, we update battery prices, vehicle costs, the number of models that are available, and we'll have the updated guidance. So I don't know yet how that's going to net out in terms of whether our projections for EV sales are higher or lower for future years than they were previously, because there's a lot of different changing factors, many of which work cross purposes. But yeah, we look at what happened in 2023, how many vehicles were leased versus bought, what was the range of vehicles, and then looking at the model list in future years, what new models are coming online and when, and then updated projections from NREL or other groups about lithium-ion battery trends to try to shape the forecast for the next few years.
Right, and maybe LFP trends, maybe even sodium-ion trends. Who knows? Who knows what could happen? So EVs are on track. This was somewhat of a surprise given the doomy vibes around EVs. In contrast, the vibes around clean electricity tend to be pretty good. Everybody loves solar and wind. They're booming. They're cheap. Everybody keeps talking about it all the time. But electricity, clean electricity, underperformed relative to model projections. Why? And by how much, I should say?
So we installed a record 33 gigawatts of utility scale renewables and storage in 2023. So there was a ton of investment, a record amount of investment, but that came in at a little bit below the bottom end of the range of projections for the year.
So this is not a catastrophic falling short. It's just a nagging more than you would like falling short.
It's like a flashing yellow light. It's like, hey, might be a problem here. Like, this needs some attention. Things are going well. Investment's growing a lot. But the pace of investment that we're going to need to deliver the 40% emission reductions projected under the IRA, let alone the 50 to 52% that the U.S. needs to hit its NDC, is just very high, very high. So while the growth is fast, it is not fast enough. And so the question is why? And there are a number of different factors that we know to be at play. It's still a little bit difficult to tell the relative weight of those factors. It kind of varies by technology, varies depending on which project developer you talk to, which equipment company you talk to. But let's run through those factors that are at play. So the first are some what we hope will be transitory factors, which are that change the economics in 2023, but that should alleviate over time. First and foremost is high interest rates, right? Clean energy is much more capital intensive than fossil electricity, and so it's much more vulnerable to interest rate increases.
Does anyone anticipate rates going down? I mean, not going up more, I think, we can expect now, but do we expect them to go down?
The futures markets, for whatever they're worth, are currently betting that the Fed will start cutting rates in the summer.
Interesting.
And I think the expectations are that the rate cuts will be gradual, not fast, so that they will start coming down, but will be coming down pretty gradually over a multi-year period.
Right. So that was mainly, it seems like that mainly hit wind. Is that right?
It disproportionately hits wind, but it hits solar and storage too. It hits wind a little bit harder because the project timelines are longer. So you're carrying your construction finance longer before you start generating revenue. Right. But wind, solar, storage, they're all capital, basically. There's no fuel costs, right? So they all, interest rates hurt all of them.
So that's one, that's transitory.
Yep. Supply chain issues that we believe to be transitory too, where that both the cost and availability of a lot of inputted goods was hard, whether that's solar tracking systems or transformers or particular wind components. That's a issue that was, you know, going to exist anyway when you're trying to quickly ramp up the amount of investment and installation you're doing, but was compounded by COVID-driven supply chain entanglement that's just taken a little bit longer to unwind. Those are the two transitory or hopefully transitory issues. Question is how quickly they go away, but they should be transitory. And then there's a list of potentially more structural challenges that are going to need to get unwound. And these are all what we describe as like non-cost barriers. So the IRA successfully makes clean electricity, you know, temporary inflation notwithstanding, makes clean electricity and clean transportation cost competitive with fossil alternatives pretty much everywhere in the country and in every application, right? But there are other barriers to the speed at which companies can realize that new cost parity in building new infrastructure and equipment, right? And this ranges from siting and permitting issues and timelines for the projects themselves, to the transmission required to connect them to the grid, to the interconnection queues that the wholesale power markets operate. So issues all well known to your listeners and regularly discussed on this podcast that will actually need policy work to address.
And I wanted to ask about those because those are, I think it's sort of the consensus these days, those are the problems now. Like the money part is... IRA takes care of the money part, and those are now the big problems, the non-cost barriers, NIMBYism, permitting, the whole bureaucratic tangle, the lack of transmission. How do you model those? I mean, do you try to work those effects into your models? And if so, how? Like, that's just, to me, that's just a total black box. I would have no idea how to predict how those things go.
Yeah, there's lots of strategies you can take. It's challenging to do, and you try to tackle it through scenario analysis rather than having a specific prediction about how quickly the residents of coastal Massachusetts will become comfortable with offshore wind turbines in their sight line. So this suite of issues definitely hits wind harder than it hits solar and storage. Mm. Right? It impacts all of clean electricity, but wind really struggles because wind is much more geographically dependent.
Yeah.
And where the best wind is usually not where electricity load is. And so getting the wind from where it blows to where the power is needed requires just much more enabling infrastructure than for solar and storage. Those solar and storage do face some of the same issues.
Yeah, so like the story in electricity overall is that solar, utility scale solar and storage more or less kept up with your model predictions, right? It was mainly wind falling short that led the whole electricity sector to fall short. Is that right?
Yeah, so they actually varied across the models. So some of the, Rhodium's models were pretty close for wind, in part just because the timelines of the wind projects in the pipeline were relatively well known. But we fell short on solar and storage. A lot of projects slipped in solar and storage into 2024. And I think that was a combination of interest rate, supply chain, interconnection queue issues. So the projects are still in the pipeline. They just got delayed into 2024. But it is true that if you look at by 2030, where the most growth needs to happen, it's in wind across all the models. Wind needs to recover from its current, you know, 6 gigawatts, paltry 6 gigawatts that were installed last year. We need to be seeing like 30 to 50 gigawatts a year of wind by 2030 being added to the grid.
So there's no It's not like solar and storage are just going to jam on the accelerator and make that up.
It's hard to imagine that, you know, if you think about, depending on the model, by the end of the decade, you know, we need to be adding 100 gigawatts a year of clean up yeah. from the 30 to 40 gigawatts a year now. We need to grow to that level. You know, you can definitely see a pathway where solar is doing 50 to 60 of that, right? From the kind of 20 to 30 to 40 we're seeing now, that growth seems pretty reasonable. I think the bigger question mark is, can wind get from the 6 gigawatts a year we saw last year up to 30 to 50 gigawatts a year by 2030.
From your perspective, and this is a totally subjective judgment, but, you know, speaking of the flashing yellow light, you know, the positive story would be this is mostly about those transitory factors and things are going to get on track again shortly. The negative story will be these non-cost barriers are deep and pathological and are going to bite harder or biting harder than people thought. And there's no resolution on the horizon. So we're going to have to downgrade our models of what wind can do. Where is your subjective sense of alarm about this on the scale of alarm?
Yeah, I mean, my guess is just because of project timelines, my guess is that the 2030 forecast for wind are going to start coming down. You know, in the next year or two across modeling groups, just because the time it takes to build transmission, the time it takes to get wind projects going, the farther you push out that pipeline, the harder it is to meet that mark in 2030. Whereas solar, again, because of less geographic dependency, shorter project lead times, it's easier for that to make up the gap. And I think that solar will fill in some of the space if wind is slower to come online in meeting the clean electricity needs of utilities and large C&I customers. And we're already seeing that happen. But we really do need a balanced portfolio of wind and solar. They're complementary resources in different geographic parts of the country. And we really do need to have both of those in the mix for a low-cost transition.
So if we're going to worry about something, let's worry about wind. You also mentioned that heat pumps, everybody's favorite, and by everybody, I mean my favorite technology, are short of your projections. Why? Is that also about interest rates, or is there something else going on there?
Yeah, that one's just interest rates. So here, it's not so much about heat pumps specifically. It's that because interest rates are high, overall residential construction activity is dropped off quite sharply. So heat pumps continue to gain market share. In 2023, they continue to gain market share relative to traditional AC and gas furnaces. But overall, heat pump installations decline quite a bit just because construction activity is down from high interest rates.
So we're not going to worry about that. We think that's transitory. We think that'll pass with interest rates.
The overall market decline will, you know, I think there's still, I would say the incentives for heat pumps relative to the cost of a heat pump installation are much less generous than the incentives for other technologies. So it's the incentive wedge that the IRA provided for heat pumps is pretty modest to start with. And so I think the effect of those incentives is going to be much more modest than what we're seeing for EVs or clean electricity.
Interesting. I wanted to ask also about e-bikes, whether you, speaking of my pet technologies, did you get down to that granularity? Can we?
We didn't, sadly, but we'll put that on the list for next year, Dave, just for you.
We'll do the e-bike forecast. We can't just do cars, Trevor. It's all about density and biking.
I know. We'll do e-bikes.
Okay. So two big success stories. Well, EVs, I guess, are a success story, but two big sort of, I think, kind of eye-popping success stories are clean energy manufacturing and emerging technologies. Let's start with manufacturing. This, it seems to me, and tell me if you agree, is kind of the headline story about IRA, just from a sort of ordinary citizen's point of view. It has sparked an extraordinary investment in manufacturing facilities, mostly, as far as I can tell, batteries. Is that right?
Yeah, EV supply chain. So everything from critical minerals to battery component materials to battery cell and modules to then vehicle assembly. So yeah, the EV supply chain, but also in solar, which is a, you know, a sector that I think a lot of people had lost hope would ever be manufactured in the U.S. And we're seeing pretty substantial new manufacturing investments in the solar supply chain as well.
Interesting. And we're seeing more manufacturing investment than modeled, or is just keeping up?
None of the groups modeled manufacturing investment, actually. But I think it has exceeded analyst expectations. It certainly exceeded our expectations on the pace. And when you look at the economics of these manufacturing facilities, it is clear that the IRA is playing a pretty transformative effect. And you see it in company filings when they're talking about to their investors the role that the IRA is playing in driving their investment decisions.
And emerging technologies, these are sort of your capital O other technologies, gap fillers. So in that, we're talking about like hydrogen, sustainable airplane fuels, things like that. What counts as emerging technologies, and what do we see in that sector?
Yeah, so the three that we're currently capturing in the Clean Investment Monitor are sustainable aviation fuels, clean hydrogen, and then carbon management, which is both like direct air capture as well as point source carbon capture. Point source carbon capture is, while it was originally envisioned as a power sector play, if you remember back to like Future Gen and this idea that we were going to have a bunch of coal plants carbon capture.
I don't think that dream is dead yet. I mean, the technology is dead, but I don't think the dream is dead.
Yeah, one of the many things for which cheap gas completely eroded the commercial logic was a coal-fired power plant with carbon capture. But where we're seeing a lot of it is in the industrial sector, in ethanol refineries, in petrochemical facilities that have relatively pure streams of CO2 that can be reasonably affordably captured.
And that's 45...
Q, 45
Q. I can't keep my 45 straight. That's 45 Q is big, right? I mean, it's a big incentive to do that.
For these emerging climate techs, the incentive is very large relative to the cost of technology. So whether you're talking about SAF or clean hydrogen or carbon capture, the incentive is very large relative to the cost. The total federal spending right now is very small because these technologies are in their early stages
very small development base.
The magnitude, small base. But the magnitude of the incentive, like for manufacturing, is quite large, pretty transformative. It's very hard to imagine a lot of these projects going forward without that federal incentive there.
Right. And that, again, was what they set out to do.
That was the plan.
attempted to do that, and it is working. It is pulling investment into those new technologies.
And I should say here for the emerging climate technologies, this is a place where the infrastructure bill actually plays a relatively large role compared to the IRA. I mean, the IRA does as well, but there were hubs programs and other incentives in the bipartisan infrastructure law specifically focused at direct air capture, clean hydrogen. And so those have played a pretty important role as well.
It will be so interesting to see how 45V, the incentives for clean hydrogen, end up looking and end up doing. like that's speaking of hard to predict and hard to model, depending on how those subsidies play out, it could really radically affect where and how much clean hydrogen gets going.
It could, yeah. To date, so we've seen a lot of green hydrogen, so electrolytic hydrogen announcements. But most of the actual investment, the projects that have proceeded in 2023 to investment, have actually been blue hydrogen projects because they are able to claim that 45Q credit, which is an existing credit, was well understood, whereas the 45V credit, we didn't get final guidance on until late last year.
Is blue hydrogen going to be able to double up and get 45Q and 45V?
Nope, you got
to
choose. You got to pick one. But you have a pathway, particularly where natural gas prices are right now. You have a pathway to potential commercial viability just with 45Q for a lot of these facilities.
So that's sort of the technology sectors. And I guess if we're kind of summarizing, it sounds like the overall message is, we're more or less on track with kind of the big footnote being the shortfall of wind, but threatening getting to, was it 40? Is that what the model said? 40% U.S. GHG reductions by 2030? Is that right?
Yeah.
That's the model prediction.
It's a range. Like we had Rodium, it was 29 to 42% was our range. But, the midpoint in most of the models was like 39, 40%.
Right. And so we're more or less on track there, except for wind. Is that kind of...
And heat pumps and building electrification is really lagging. Now, we don't know yet what that will look like once interest rates correct. So it may be that the trend for building electrification will be just fine once interest rates normalize. But as of right now, we're not making enough progress there.
Right. So, yeah, just I guess yell about wind one more time, or yell about transmission one more time, yell about NIMBYism one more time. Like everything, you know, our hopes for IRA are coming down to that stuff. We can't get around it much longer. I had a couple of other sort of quasi-political questions to wrap up with. Is it true? I think that the sort of story that is going around now is that the bulk of investment, both public and private, is going into red states. Is that true?
You know, we haven't actually crunched those numbers specifically. The Center for American Progress uses the data from the Clean Investment Monitor, and I think they have a breakdown by congressional district there, so you could look it up on that. But I can certainly, just eyeballing the like league tables of state investment, particularly if you look at it relative to the size of the economy, right? So where is clean investment playing the largest role in the...
Right, most transformative.
Right. If you're looking at total investment, total clean investment is a share of state GDP.
Mm.
The top five is Nevada, South Carolina, Arizona, Tennessee, and Montana, followed by Kentucky, Wyoming, Georgia, and Kansas. Then you get to California at number 10.
Yeah, so, you know, in addition to all the other big question marks around IRA, to me, this is one of the most interesting and something that, sadly, one cannot model, which is what political effects this will have. You know, one of the sort of hot discussions among climate people right now is how much of this would survive if Trump took office. How much are red states attached to this flood of new investment? I suppose you probably don't have any more educated guess about that than anybody else, though.
I don't. I mean, I think that it will be a tension between potential desire by Republican leadership to roll back a marquee piece of legislation by the Biden administration in tension with the home state interests of a number of Republican members who have executives and employees calling their senator representative saying, like, this new factory is happening in my hometown because of these incentives. And if they go away, we won't see continued investment, or we might see a factory closure.
Yeah, well, I hope we don't have to run that experiment, but...
I leave it to you, Dave, to pontificate on whether a desire to own the libs beats out home state economic interest or not.
I will always bet on owning the libs, but maybe we'll find out. Another quasi-political question, and I know you are also a bit of a China expert in your spare time. And I'm curious if you have any general thoughts about how IRA and Bill and whatever the third one is that I can never think of, how they affected other countries' strategies, the passage of the bill and the subsequent investment boom, how they've affected other countries, like how China, for instance, is responding. Do you think it's galvanizing other countries? Because, you know, like from Europe, you hear a lot of complaints about, you know, the sort of domestic content requirements and those kind of things being basically a form of protectionism, like we're sort of illegally subsidizing our own manufacturers, which is supposed to be against World Bank rules. You know, you hear a lot of that from Europe, but then you also hear from like Australia, you know, like they're just like inspired by, galvanized by the IRA and rushing to do their own thing. So I wonder if you have any sense, you know, China specifically, but in general of kind of the net effect on other countries' aspirations and policies.
So I guess I would tackle that in two ways. One is, what is the overall effect of the passage of the IRA? And then a second is, what is the effect of the manufacturing incentives in particular within the IRA, right? The more industrial policy component of the IRA. So I would say the effect of the passage of the IRA as a whole is unequivocally supportive of clean energy deployment policy in the rest of the world because it is vital for the U.S. to meet its NDC. And it is the backbone of any credible story the U.S. can tell about how it might have a pathway to meet its climate commitment, right? So since we operate in this pledge and review international climate architecture, it is vital that large emitting countries like the U.S. are able to demonstrate a credible pathway to meet their targets to ensure there's incentive for other countries to do the same. And the IRA has definitely had that effect. If you look specifically at the manufacturing incentives in the IRA, which, as we talked about, have been fairly transformative in terms of the pace of manufacturing investment, I think, interestingly, to date, the causal chain, I think it's China had a significant impact on the adoption of those incentives in the U.S., right? I think the build-out of a domestic clean energy manufacturing base in China, which has been primarily to serve Chinese domestic demand to date, right? That's where the vast majority of Chinese solar panels and Chinese EVs go, is within China, that increased the odds of the U.S. seeking to support the growth of a similar clean energy manufacturing base in the U.S., right? I think that directionally, the passage of the IRA has increased calls in Europe for incentives for clean energy manufacturing in Europe as well. That's running a bit into some pretty tough budget realities that Europe's grappling with right now. So it's not clear how much effect that'll have. More broadly, what we're seeing right now is there's kind of two different ways to do clean energy industrial policy and to try to support a domestic industry. And I think it's clear that in all major economies, the adoption of sustained, ambitious climate policy requires having a domestic industrial base that's getting to benefit from that, just for the politics of it, right?
Just politically, you mean?
Right. So put aside whether you believe, just as an economic matter, industrial policy is good or bad, on which economists will debate until the end of time, is a necessary ingredient in the formula for political success on climate. It's pretty important, right? That industrial policy can take one of two forms. One is incentives and subsidies, lowering the cost of clean energy manufacturing, right? I see that as broadly supportive of the pace of global deployment. It expands supportive of our climate goals, right? There's no tension there really between industrial policy and solving climate change. Those incentives, like the ones we see in the IRA, are expanding the amount of production capacity available to the world and lowering the cost of producing clean energy technology, right? And like we talked about in the case of utility scale wind and solar, we need to build a lot of this stuff. We need a lot of manufacturing capacity. Now, your Econ 101 professor would quibble that it is distorting optimal allocation of capital in the market by doing that. But
yes, which is just to say, like, if you, the intuitive, you know, Econ 101 take here is, if you want to decarbonize as fast as possible, you buy the cheapest possible decarbonization technology from wherever it's made. That's how you maximize speeds. And anything else almost definitionally reduces you from your optimal speed.
But actually, the subsidies don't cut against that. The subsidies make things cheaper, right? So they increase speed. So subsidizing expanded manufacturing capacity makes clean energy technology cheaper globally. It does not raise the cost of it for anyone.
Right.
It does. So what the Econ 101 professor's quibble would be that it's allocating too much capital to clean energy investment that should be going somewhere else from like an economically optimal standpoint, right? I'm okay if at the end of the day in solving climate, the cost was some slightly suboptimal global capital allocation. That seems like not too bad of a deal. So if we're doing industrial policy through incentives and subsidies, then we're making clean energy cheaper. We're accelerating the pace of deployment, broadly defined, right? The other way to do clean energy industrial policy and to support a domestic industry is through barriers and tariffs, where you are not allowing in goods from other countries.
There, the Econ 101 objection bites a little.
Correct. And that is where there actually is a tension between the pace of clean energy deployment and your domestic industrial policy goals, right? To date, the U.S. and most other countries have actually been primarily leaning on the former. Let's support the expansion of a domestic clean energy industrial base through subsidies and incentives. A
couple of solar tariffs.
So generally, and then there have been a couple of very high profile and important cases of tariff barriers. I think one of the defining challenges for the next decade for policymakers in the U.S. and around the world is as these incentives build out a meaningfully sized domestic industrial base, those domestic industries are going to start pressing for tariff protection.
Right, as they do. And
this is where it's going to require, you know, pretty clear-eyed and prudent policymaking on how to both support the growth of domestic industrial capacity and ensure that we're delivering clean energy at scale and as cheaply as possible around the world to meet our climate goals. But that's to date, fortunately, the industrial policy goals of the US and China and the European Union and the climate goals have actually not been that much in tension.
Right. Perhaps worth mentioning that Trump proposes a wide range of these latter strategies, tariffs and barriers and et cetera. Like the Econ 101 objections do not seem to much trouble him.
They do not.
Okay, so wrapping up, I've actually got a whole pod on this subject coming a little bit later, but I'd love to just a few thoughts from you based on your close-up view of how IRA was put together and how it's performed. What in the unlikely event that Biden won and Dems won Congress again, both houses of Congress again, in the highly unlikely event that Dems got another trifecta in 2024, what would you advise for IRA Part 2? Like, or if you had a couple of top items.
So if we like broaden that to like legislative, you know, legislative agenda too. So the first piece would be for the technologies that IRA made cost competitive, what are the non-cost barriers standing in the way to the speed and scale we need, right? So that's one category. And then the other is...
Can't do that through reconciliation.
Cannot do that through... Well, there's some pieces of it you might be able to, but most of it you can't do through reconciliation. The second is the sectors where we're just now starting to build out the technologies. And like we talked about with emerging climate technology, IRA provides important early technological development incentives. But for things like industry and agriculture and land use, you know, as transportation, surface transportation and power decline, the largest source of emissions in the U.S. will be industry.
It was just last year or the year before that transportation overtook electricity.
2016, transport overtook electricity.
Was that 2016?
Yep.
What is time even
time's
mean?
A circle.
Time's a flat circle. Okay, so cars overtook electricity in 2016 as the top emitting sector in the U.S. Presumably, IRA's going to bend that curve down. They're both going to go down. And at some point, industry is going to become the top sector emitting in the U.S. What year does that happen?
All right. Well, if you count industry like we do, which includes the process emissions and the production and transport of oil and gas, right? So important caveat there. If you include that, then by 2026,
really?
Industry will be the largest source of emissions in the U.S.
Real soon. So electricity is going down. Is transportation going down yet?
It is, gradually, more gradually than power, but it's going down.
And is industry still going up?
Industry is still going up.
All right, 2026 is when is that going to happen? Anyway, I interrupted your second half of your answer. Your first half is the non-cost barriers to the scale technologies, which, you know, are stressing everybody out right now. Part two is what again?
is the harder to decarbonize parts of the economy, which count for about half of emissions. So that's industry, which we've pretty much not touched at all from a decarbonization standpoint.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Agriculture and waste, and hard to electrify transportation. So sustainable aviation fuel, maritime transport. Now, the IRA is making some important early technology development investments, but scaling those is going to require a different set of policies.
Yeah, well, on that note, one of the things I'm trying to wrap my head around is we've got this set of tools that we used for this first round of legislation, mostly IRA, that seem to be working as projected, as planned. Are those tools, is it just a matter of taking those same tools and applying them to these new sectors, or are these remaining sectors going to require novel policy instruments?
I think some of the same tools could work. So if you're thinking about cement as a segment, and what do we do to produce low carbon cement?
Right.
You could certainly imagine a tax expenditure-based approach where it is a tax credit for production of low carbon cement. That would certainly work. There are other policy instruments that can work as well. You can develop portfolio standards for industrial goods. You can use Clean Air Act regulations for industrial sources. There's other options as well. Tax credits have proven to be the most popular and durable form of yes. climate policy in the U.S.
For better or worse.
Yeah, the appetite in the future to continue using that as the primary vehicle for federal incentives, I think, will depend in part on what the budget looks like and appetite for more tax-based spending.
Yeah. Agriculture, though, like that is, I mean, it's a whole different pod, I guess, but it's somewhat of a mystery to me. I guess I just kind of want to emphasize that it's not obvious if you sat down to write IRA 2 today what you would write.
Yes, that's correct.
I don't know that we're not nearly as prepared for these next sectors as we were for what we did this time.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
All right. Well, this is super interesting. And presumably, you know, you guys are still tracking, like, I guess one thing to say by way of wrapping up, and it's just an important caveat, is this is all relatively new. Like, these are huge pieces of legislation, transformative. There are going to be long-term effects too. And as we said, like, lots of the money still hasn't gone out the door yet. A lot of some of the tax credits are not even in place yet. Some of the other programs are not stood up yet. So we should just flag, like, these are early days.
Absolutely. And we'll be on the Clean Investment Monitor, we'll be every quarter releasing updated investment numbers and updated public spending numbers. And users can download the full underlying database to do their own analysis on as well.
Oh, fun, fun, fun. All right. All right, Trevor, thanks so much. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
Thank you for listening to the Volts Podcast. It is ad-free, powered entirely by listeners like you. If you value conversations like this, please consider becoming a paid Volts subscriber at volts.wtf. Yes, that's volts.wtf, so that I can continue doing this work. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.